You're listening to Through the Dark Woods podcast, and I'm your host, Josiah Tamira Crossley. If you're looking for support to work with your own grief or training in how to support others through grief and trauma, or would like to find out more about our amazing online community, check out darkwoodsofgrief.com. All right. I am super grateful and honored to be here with this incredible crew of humans today. As you all know, if you've been following me for a while, I'm Josiah, and my ancestry is Irish and British, and I'm living as a settler on Cleomin territory. I'm also here with my dear friend and colleague, Amber Keith, and who comes from Scottish and German ancestry. And what's the territory that you're living on out there called? Blackfoot. Okay, yeah, of course. Yeah, Blackfoot Nation. And Jane Spielman, who is Eastern European Ashkenazi Jewish from Hungary, Poland, and Russia. And Caroline and Daniela, who are sisters and come from Lebanese and Palestinian parents. So we are here today to talk about what's happening right now in Gaza, and also a little bit about kind of the longer timeline of, you know, what's been happening there for the last really over 100 years now. Yeah, the occupation. And yeah, just to share stories, share perspectives, and you know, bring some love to the situation that has been so horrific and brutal to be bearing witness to the last 4 months, but I mean, much longer than that really, but especially the intensity the last 4 months. So yeah, so I want to start by more fully introducing Amber. So Amber, of course, works on my team as a facilitator in the Through the Dark Woods group. And she has worked for the past 6 years closely with youth leading and designing transformational, experiential, and outdoor education programming that focuses on leadership, social emotional skills, rites of passage, and community building. Additionally, she spent many years working with and advocating for refugees, women's rights, Indigenous sovereignty, and environmental justice. Amber has a BA in international studies from Simon Fraser University and has spent time living in a number of different places, including traveling in Gaza and Egypt. She currently resides in the ancestral lands of the Tlaquiat Nation, colonially named Tofino. So thanks for being here with us today, Amber. And yeah, I just would love to ask you to share a little bit about your perspective as, you know, coming into traveling in that area and what you witnessed coming in as, you know, a fairly relatively neutral person to what was happening there.
Of course. Thank you. So grateful to be here in conversation today. And like you said, bringing in the love and bringing in the personal to the political. And so for me, I went to the Middle East. I think it was 2012, right after the Arab Spring. Part of my studies, international studies and development, was my major. And I went there as my study abroad option. More interested in development work and more interested in history rather necessarily than the politics. So I went in a little bit unknowing as to what exactly the climate was and what exactly the issue in the Middle East exactly was. Nobody really knew or still really knows, they think at least, before going in. It's always complicated. It's always, you know, people just can't get along. Why can't the religions get along? That was kind of the narrative that I was, you know, given as someone who grew up in what's now called North America. And so when I went, I was really lucky to be part of a really critical faculty of graduate and undergraduate students who came from all over and who really began to, like, slowly, not intentionally, but really educate me on what was happening in the region. Of course, from an Egyptian perspective, but also just from all the different students of different backgrounds who were there, people who were from Europe, from other places in the Middle East, like Jordan and Lebanon, people from other continents. And so it was really eye-opening to hear, okay, what is Palestine? Like, how did Israel get there? What is Israel? And I slowly started to learn just by being in that region and hearing people's stories about people who had lived there, who had been there. And learning as I started to plan my own trip to go with some friends, and I somehow ended up with a group of friends who were super radical and super, super pro-Palestine, which was amazing. And they really helped me. They're such kind, beautiful people. And so we planned to go on a trip during actually the Easter break, because they were all also somewhat had their own spirituality and religion. And, you know, that's the hub, right? So we had planned to go to Jerusalem and then travel around both the Israeli territories and then Palestinian land as well. And so on that trip, we were warned multiple times, like, when you're crossing the border, like, it's not going to be easy. Like, the Israeli border agents are going to give you a hard time. And this was coming from other white or white presenting students, not the Arab students. They were saying, like, from their personal experience, from other people's experience, like, this is going to be rough. Don't tell them you're learning Arabic. Don't give them any information you don't need to. They're going to really question you. And I had heard stories about them being detained for hours and hours at a time. And part of me didn't really believe it, you know, growing up with privilege too. I was like, you know, what kind of a hard time will they give me? And my friends, who are also most of them, not all of them, but most of them white or white presenting. And just, you know, studying at a university in Egypt. And so when we went, it was a really, really eye-opening, horrifying experience. And just like the gateway to like the racism and the lived reality of the people who are in those territories, we were questioned harshly, like very cruelly as well, like without hesitation, without any pretension either. You know, they weren't pretending. They asked us why we were learning Arabic, why we'd want to, why were we living in the Middle East? Why were we living in Egypt? Why would we want to do that? Like, just very, and I mean, my tone isn't conveying like how harsh it was. And it was a long time we were in there being questioned before they finally let us through. And a couple of my friends were like visibly shaken and were crying afterwards because some had stayed longer than me. And it was just a mess. And that was just the first step. And the rest of the trip was, I mean, both beautiful. The land and the people are incredible everywhere, you know, Israelis, Palestinians, everyone's wonderful. But the political infrastructure was so apparent. Like, I had no idea what to expect. And going in and seeing the wall for the first time, like, as someone who didn't have any, like, any part in the game, you know, coming in, like, I felt it. Like, I saw that wall, and it was horrifying. It like really represented that power of evil. And then going across the wall and spending many days in the Palestinian territories in some places that were more frequented by, you know, tourists, like Bethlehem. Everyone goes to Bethlehem, but we went all over and to places that tourists never go as well. And it was just one at once very beautiful. Like, the Palestinian people were so lovely, and I still have, you know, like, an I Heart Palestine t-shirt. I still have little like things people gave me. I still have memories of talking to like shopkeepers and like seeing the conditions they were in, and like seeing the Israeli army people with like their guns, and seeing their attitudes too, seeing people get harassed on the buses, seeing Arab people get like targeted over and over and over again with like such cruelty. Like, for me, it was the first time I'd really witnessed that level of like apparent racism. And I came out radicalized, you know, I came out like really understanding from this like lived experience I had, even though it was only a few weeks. I mean, I spent a longer time in Egypt, very close by, and traveled around the areas and other countries too. And honestly, it never left me. And it's been radical, you know, since then, since 2012, to speak out in favor of Palestine. And I really didn't understand what it would bring upon me as well to speak out about Palestine. And when all of this started on October 7th, not all of this started, but when people started speaking out in this like grander way on October 7th, when that kind of just sparked something, obviously this has been going on for so many years. It was both horrifying and beautiful to see, like, okay, this is our time to speak. You know, we, no one's listened to us before. No one's listened about the Palestinian issue before this, but it's existed. You know, it was 10 years ago, more than that, that I visited, and things were already much in progress. Like, it was settled. You know what was happening. It was the colonizer and the colonized. And yeah, I'm just really grateful to be able to use my voice. I'm grateful to be here with friends who support this cause. And yeah, just wanted to give my perspective from someone who visited and who it never, that place never left me. It had no reason, you know, to stay with me necessarily, but it did. And that says something. So yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah. So I want to turn now to Daniela. So Daniela is a clinical counselor and also works on my team supporting many people who come for grief support. And she brings really a wealth of knowledge and expertise to the work. She's a highly skilled therapist, but also just I really want to speak to her huge heart and the huge heart that she shows up to every interaction that I've had with her, every conversation. It's just this huge heart. And yeah, I just feel so grateful to have this connection with you, Daniela, and would love to, yeah, just invite you and Caroline to speak a bit more to your story. And actually, maybe I'll just introduce Caroline now as well, and then you guys can kind of riff back and forth and have a, you know, have a conver-, well, the three of us can have a conversation. So Caroline is a pediatric emergency nurse who specializes in child and adolescent mental health. And like Daniela, of course, because they're sisters, born to a Lebanese refugee mother and a Palestinian refugee father. And so yeah, really, really grateful to have you both here to share your personal story of, yeah, your ancestry being in that area.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Josiah. We're so grateful to be here. Thank you so much for amplifying our voices and our stories. We're so grateful. And I just want to say to Amber that I feel so heard hearing, you know, your story and you being in Palestine and interacting with Palestinians and having a true experience of what Palestinians are like and what our culture is like. And despite everything that Palestinians go through, our father always taught us and to just be welcoming to everyone, no matter the color, race, religion. That's how we were raised, to always be welcoming. And I remember when I was a young girl in high school, one of my best friends was Israeli Jewish, and she slept over, she had dinners with us. And we actually didn't, I didn't even know about the conflict because my father didn't want us to grow up having any negative feelings towards Israelis or Jews. So just you sharing your experience, Amber, I just feel so heard and seen as a Palestinian, because we're often portrayed as bad and, you know, and terrorists and animals and all kinds of stuff. So thank you. Thank you for seeing us, and thank you for hearing us, and thank you for giving us a chance. Thank you. Coco, if you, Caroline, if you want to add to this.
I want to echo that, and I want to say thank you for giving us a firsthand experience of what traveling through those lands is like, because we've never had the privilege to actually step foot on, you know, that land. And you know, I know that the day will come that we will be able to, as a family, return and visit, but it's just has not been possible for us through the years. And I also want to acknowledge what you said about, you know, the things are shifting and people are speaking and people are hearing, because I attended my very first protest, a pro-Palestine protest, 20 years ago here in Vancouver. And every few years, as the assaults on Gaza happen or on other parts of Palestine happen, we amplify our voices a little bit more. But this is by far, since October 7th, has been by far the most activity I've seen, you know, globally regarding Palestine, you know. And generally, you know, in previous years when the assaults happen, You know, you see people get amped up for a couple of weeks and then it kind of dies down a little bit. But now we're like, you know, 120 plus days into this, and people are still speaking out, if not maybe even louder than they were before. So I am seeing, I'm feeling this shift that's happening, and it's thanks to every single one of us here and those around the world that are continuing to use their voices. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Yeah. So I'm wondering if we want to start with, if you could share the story, your father's story of, yeah, growing up in Gaza.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want to go ahead?
You can start, Caroline, and I'll add to it.
Yeah. So dad was born in Jabalia, which is a small town in the north of Gaza, and which at the time when he was born in 1953, Jabalia was the largest refugee camps for other Palestinians that had needed to find refuge after the Nakba in 1948. So Jabalia was home to lots and lots of refugees from surrounding parts of Palestine. At the age of 16, he took part in handing out flyers for a protest, an upcoming protest for Palestine. And he was caught, his friends and him were caught handing out the protest flyers. And so they were jailed, like many other Palestinian children and youth are, you know, on a daily basis, right? And they're not, you know, afforded the right to justice. Like there's no representation, legal representation or anything. They're sort of, you know, in jail for, you know, in definite sort of timelines. And so at the time, he, lucky for him, his dad, our grandpa was, or his grandpa actually was the mayor of their small town. And so he was able to negotiate with the Israeli Defense Forces around the release of my father, but it was conditional. So the options were, you either he stays in jail forever, and there's no release, or he needs to go on exile forever, never return back, no right of return. So you know, being so young, the family decided to get him out of jail and send him out with a little bit of money, you know, to give him a chance at life as opposed to staying in jail forever. So that was his journey. That's when our journey as a family started, you know, family of refugees. He made his way through different parts of the Middle East. He went into Jordan, went into Syria, and then from Syria made his way to Lebanon, which is where, you know, thankfully he was able to thrive and, you know, meet our mom and all that. But I think probably the most difficult part for me as a child growing up, I remember always asking about, because we'd met my mom's parents, we'd met mom and, you know, our grandparents from mom's side, but we'd never met anyone from that side of the family. And he never spoke about them. So we never really knew who our aunts and uncles were and cousins. So we really didn't have any relationship with them. And the only time I ever heard dad talk about his mom and dad is when he was able to go visit them. But the visit was, again, conditional, right? Because everyone in Gaza under occupation, under siege, needs permission from Israel to leave and come back in. So if you leave and, you know, they give you, say, for example, they give you 24 to 48 hours to return and they tell you where you're allowed to go. So my grandma, dad's mom, was given a permission to leave Gaza for 48 hours, but she was only allowed to go to Egypt to meet dad. And if she doesn't return within the 48-hour window, then she's not allowed to come back into Gaza again. So dad, after leaving Palestine and when he was 16 years old, didn't see his mom again until he was in his mid-40s. He got 48 hours in Egypt with mom and his sister. And a year later, his dad got also a pass to be able to exit for 48 hours. So from 16 years old until my dad passed away 6 years ago at the age of 65, he'd only ever seen his mom and dad again once. And, you know, his siblings and other family members, like that was it, you know, that was it. So I can only imagine what that was like. If I could feel it as a young girl, you know, missing that presence that, you know, the grandma and grandpa and aunts and uncles that we never got to know. I can't imagine what that was like for him. Yeah.
I have a 16-year-old son, and hearing that, I'm just like, I cannot imagine him leaving, and, you know, and how, not only for me as his mother, but also for him, and how, you know, and from what I've witnessed, also, like, Palestinian families are very close. Yeah. Like, very close.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, and that trauma just kind of continued, right? I mean, this is only the early parts of dad's life, you know, as a Palestinian refugee, but, you know, the story goes on about how he makes his way out of Lebanon and through, you know, and surviving through different wars and all at the hands of the Zionist regime, right? This is the same perpetrator wherever you are in the Middle East. This is kind of the same story, and that just kind of followed him throughout. You know, I could carry on, but I want to give my sister an opportunity also to jump in.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to exactly the point you're making, Caroline. I wanted to add that when my parents got married, they were pregnant, when they were pregnant with me, in 1982, Israel also attacked Lebanon at that time. And they, my understanding is that they were chasing out the Palestinians out of Lebanon. And so it wasn't safe for dad to stay there. And my mom, I believe, was 8 months pregnant. Mm-hmm. with me, and they had to leave. So, you know, here's my dad now having to leave again. So they drove to Italy because we had family there on my mom's side. We had an uncle there, and they ended up having me there, but it was not an option for them. Once they had me, it was not an option for them to go back, of course, to Gaza, but also to Lebanon. And so that's how we made our journey to the Ivory Coast. We ended up fleeing to the Ivory Coast and becoming refugees there. And my sisters and I grew up in the Ivory Coast. So that is also how we got disconnected from our mom's side of the family, even though we still had a relationship with them. We didn't get to grow up in that environment with our family on my mom's side because, again, of Israel.
And, you know, I just want to add in there, too, that I think we simplify a little bit when we say that, you know, they had to leave. They drove, you know, they went in the car and drove from Lebanon all the way to Italy. But, you know, to share some of the hardship that they went through, like, you know, my dad being Palestinian in Lebanon, he was a refugee in Lebanon. And in order for him to leave Lebanon at the time in 1982, when they were looking to flee because mom was pregnant and about to give birth, they had to go. I mean, it took the courage of an entire community to get dad out of Lebanon, right? Because they were looking for Palestinians and they purposely did not want to let Palestinians leave. So that they ended up creating, they used a passport from one of my, you know, deceased uncles and put dad's picture on it. Like, it took an entire community of people to create this, to get dad safely, dad, mom, and Daniela out of Lebanon. And, you know, traveling by car through the different countries, you know, like going through Turkey and through Greece and then hopping on a boat and from the boat getting to Italy. So it's, you know, I know we often hear of refugee stories nowadays, you know, modern days. And we think, you know, they have to hop on boats and it's, you know, all the hardship that they have to go through. That's what our parents had to go through, you know, to make their way to the Ivory Coast. So it's just been, it's been quite a journey. And again, I want to, you know, reiterate that at the hands of the very same perpetrator, you know.
I
just want to add also, just to give you an insight of how my father was, and not to get too much into it, but also there's been a lot of issues between Muslims and Christians in Lebanon. There's been a lot of conflict, and my dad had a neighbor that was Christian, and my dad helped protect him and hide him when his life, you know, was at stake. And my dad helped this guy. And this is the same person that actually helped my dad leave. But that's who my dad was. My dad never, you know, looked at people for their religion, their color, their belief systems. He just looked at human beings as humans.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I was going to bring that up again, just to like really underline the point of like that. So this man who was basically had to flee because of Israel and then again flee the Israeli, you know, the IDF, and then he taught you to be friends with Israeli people and Jewish people still.
And that never changed, I must say, like that never changed through the years, through the different assaults that were, you know, increasingly more aggressive over time. That his perspective and his teachings around love and acceptance never shifted, you know, that was always the same. Yeah. So and so that to me, that's a real example that you know, and I really want to say this as loud and clearly as possible, that Jewish people are safe within our communities, and Jewish people are safe in our homes, and you know, and Jewish people are invited, are welcome, you know, in our homes, in our communities, in our towns, and you know, wherever. So that right there is an example to defeat that sort of narrative that, you know, Jewish people aren't safe around Arabs, whether we're Muslim or Christian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just to add to that, I had Israeli friends as a teenager and as an adult. And, you know, we were never those people that would be challenging conversations, or we just really just welcomed them as humans. And that comes from that seed that our father planted.
Beautiful. Yeah. And I mean, I think what I want to outline here too, or underline here too, is that, like, from what I've witnessed of since I started really directing my attention to, like, witnessing Palestinian culture, witnessing, like, so many of these Palestinian people who are sharing their experience on social media, who are you know, responding to posts that, you know, people like me and you know, but that Gabor Mate is sharing, you know, and then seeing all the Palestinian response, it's like so much gratitude coming forward from them for any support that they are receiving, you know, and doesn't matter if it's, you know, Jewish people supporting or who's supporting. It's like, and I read one person's comment on Gabor Mate's video yesterday, and they just said, you know, the Jewish people who are supporting us are giving us life right now, you know, and so there is a deep recognition of that. And you know, I guess I'm sure that also, you know, that there is a spectrum of how Palestinian people feel about Israelis and Jewish people, you know, and one thing that Gabor said in his talk yesterday as well is that the founder of Hamas, he witnessed his uncle being murdered by the IDF in front of him at the age of 8 years old.
Yeah.
And so having that kind of trauma, experiencing that kind of trauma, again, like, you know, we may in the West think of, like, oh, an uncle, it's like, oh yeah, this guy I kind of know, you know, for me anyways, that's my uncles. But like, Palestinian families are close. So like, this probably would have been someone who is like his father, and he witnessed him being killed. And like, I don't condone or support violence. I mean, I don't think violence is ever the answer, you know, to anything. I mean, and it's like, it's completely understandable that somebody would want to respond in that way, because especially, like, how else do you respond when you're speaking and speaking and speaking and speaking and speaking and trying to get your voice heard? It's like, how else do you respond? How do you get your voice heard? So anyways,
and I don't think in the history of humankind or of mankind, I don't think there's ever been a liberation of the people that didn't stem from the resistance at some point, right? So you don't get liberation by talking nice or, you know, having big group meetings and chatting about, you know, who gets what. That doesn't actually serve anyone. And we've witnessed that, because this is what's happened with colonization throughout the ages. So, you know, this is, and that's the hard part, I think, as Palestinians here, is, you know, people, that's the first question everyone asks is, do you condemn Hamas? And I find that to be such a stupid question, excuse my language, it means absolutely nothing. And, but, you know, people need to find something to get stuck on. And that's really sad, truly, because rather than looking for, you know, the experience of the people, you know, like, when we talk, I can tell you this with certainty, when we talk to our family members in Gaza, and we usually make contact at least once a day, I've yet, you know, in 4 months, I've yet to hear them say a single negative word about the Israelis or the Jewish, not even the IDF. I kid you not. I promise you, I've never heard them say anything. at all.
And we have everything on that. Yeah.
It's all documented. We have it in voice messages. We have it in text messages. And I don't know where like these people get this strength, this like this trust, this faith, and you know, to still carry on and not show a single ounce of hatred or anger. All they keep asking is keep praying for us. Don't ever forget about us. And we can't wait for this war to be over so we can see you again. That's what they say.
Yeah. And to add to this, to your comment, Josiah, about the leader of Hamas, just like a couple of weeks ago, I was having a conversation with a friend that was telling me about his childhood and how strict his father was and how his mother used to beat them and like really, you know, beat all of them. And I said, when did it stop? And he said, when he saw that I was resisting. I showed him that I can fight back. And it's not the first time I hear this as a mm-hmm. person speaking to friends that have gone through similar experiences, but also as a counselor. I have heard that story. When do people stop? Do parents stop beating the kid? Is when they see that the kid now can fight back. Mm-hmm. So if that's going to stop a parent from abusing their kid, how is that not okay for Palestinians?
Mm-hmm. The beautiful analogy. This is Jane. And I've worked for 5 decades with kids and in education. It's the analogy is perfect. I think on the white left, which I've been a part of also for over 5 decades, we have self-criticisms about, although we were anti-Zionist all these years, it took what Hamas did to explode the code, you know, that now Palestine is leading the world in morals and ethics, and all of us have to follow and listen to what the Palestinians are saying about what your future is, that it's not up to us, it's not up to anybody but Palestinians to make these decisions about what is going to happen. Is it the river to the sea? I mean, it was not a land without people for a people without land, as Herzl argued. And my father-in-law said, there are people there. And he said it wasn't Jewish. And similar to what you're describing, I want to meet your father. I know he's gone, but I want to meet this man. So I'm crying about it. I think somebody needs to write this story about this amazing human being. But like him, my father-in-law, when he was in Bergen-Belsen, he was carrying a book with him to the shower. It was a Hebraic book, you know, of holy Judaism. And a Nazi came in and found him with the prayer book, and it was actually a Heschel book. And somehow in the magic of that moment, he comes out of the shower and the Nazi is like, it's just yours. He says in Hebrew. And Henry, my father-in-law, said, yes, it's mine. And they had a discussion in Hebrew. It was, and he let him, he didn't kill him. You know, later he was punished for other reasons. But he maintained his, there are people there already. So I think this nature of humanness. And yes, of course, Hamas somebody had to put it on the map. And it's sad if people die, but the Black Panthers in the US, it was the same. You know, somebody had to say, we have the right to self-defense, you know, because we have been colonized and oppressed. And what you were describing as you traveled, your father, and you traveled from place to place, I was thinking, you know, would you say now that Harriet Tubman freeing slaves would be illegal, of course, and slave uprisings, you know, the Haitians uprisings against the French, illegal, you know, civil war, You know, I mean, you know, insurrection against the oppressor is, you know, it can't be illegal. This is not a legal nation. It's a settler colony, Israel. It's a settler colony. And Jews, there were many Jews who didn't agree, many very religious Jews who said, this is not in Torah to take over somebody else's land. Every demonstration I go to here in New York City on the land unceded from the Lenni Lenape, every demonstration I go to, there are religious Jews in full religious clothing, black, you know, hats in the rain covered with, you know, they're not allowed to hold an umbrella on the Sabbath, so they just cover their hats with plastic. But they come out in the rain, they're always there. This is not Jewish to be doing what's being done. It's to me, it's deeply anti-Semitic.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit more about the history, because I'm just learning the history of the area. But what I understand, and I'd love to just hear from the rest of you, who maybe know a little bit more than me, but what I understand from the reading that I've been doing over the last few months is that that Palestine was a British colony, in the sense that the British were controlling that area and managing it, and that after the Second World War, they thought it would be a great idea to take this to band with the Zionist Jewish organization, which is a relatively actually small number of Jewish people relative to like the full Jewish population on the globe, and create a colony that was Jewish governed there. And of course it was done with force and a lot of violence. Someone referred earlier, one of you referred to the Nakba. I'd love to just hear from you a little bit more about that. Maybe let's go to Daniela. I'm seeing you like really nodding your head. Like, yeah, I want to talk about that. Yeah, you go. Or Caroline. Yeah.
Actually, Caroline knows a lot more about the history, so I'd love for her to jump in.
I mean, I'll tell you what I do know about it. I think, you know, the Nakba was in 1948, right? So post-World War II, you know, when all the Jews had so sadly been, you know, persecuted in Eastern Europe. You know, some, you know, rich old white man decided that it would be a good idea to hand over a piece of land that was not empty of people, as you said, Jane. It was not a people without a land for a land without a people. And the idea that I think, in my opinion, is a delusion, was a purely Jewish state in a binational country. I mean, how do you create that, right? So prior to the Nakba, I mean, Jewish, Christians, Muslim, we've heard this tons and tons over and over again, coexisted in the land of Palestine. You know, that was named Palestine, right? And, you know, over time, when the British handed over the piece of land and said, okay, you guys come over here, they gave them 51%, I can't remember the exact number, and Palestine was left with 49%. So they gave a majority of the land, and, you know, they were to kind of, you know, thrive and coexist and so forth. But that that didn't go quite as planned, because then the British then kind of said, okay, well, we're done with this. We don't want to have anything to do with this. We're going to hand it over. And then they just left us, you know, they just kind of abandoned. And then that's just how slowly over time the settlers began to take over more and more and more of the land of Palestine. And I'm sure you've seen the images over time of, you know, the settlements take over Palestine, and to the point where, you know, 20 or 30 years later, they created that complete partition, like that wall that Amber was speaking to earlier. And Palestine, now they have different systems to like, it is an apartheid state. There's no doubt about it, you know, in every aspect that you look at, because of the way that they've the different rights and the different taxes and the different everything. So people are not treated equally. And Palestinians don't have the right to come and go as they please. They shut down their airport. their ports, like their seaports. They've shut down their ability to come and go as they please. There's absolutely no freedom. And that's not just in Gaza, right? In other parts of, you know, of Palestine's in the West Bank, the occupied territories, like these are all, they're all like Palestinians that just simply don't have any freedom to be Palestinian in that, in their own land. So, yeah, that's kind of, you know, how it goes to way back to 1948 and how it all started, but it was not an empty land of people. That's for sure.
And so the Israelis had to institute very official alternate narratives, which they call Hasbara, which is propaganda meant to get the buy-in of not just the Israelis in the occupied territory, but all over the world, Jews and everybody, that the Jews have a right to be here, you know, the poor Jews, but it's a scam on Jews. It used Jews to have, excuse me, sorry, a military outpost in the Middle East where there's a lot of oil. And we know from Vietnam that, you know, what did Vietnam mean? Why spend so much time and energy trying and failing, by the way, to overcome this little people, this small little country, failing? All the French and the US failed, which gives us hope for the Palestinian from the river to the sea. You know, if the Vietnamese could win, then, you know, but that was because of oil too and military outposts. And so we've been used as Jews, and the terrible tragedy of the Holocaust, the terrible tragedy of 6 million people, you know, dead, whole families slaughtered, you know, children, you know, ripped from, you know, just, you know, go to the Holocaust Museum, look at hundreds and hundreds of pairs of shoes, you know, so that tragedy has been used by the British and by the opportunist Israelis to say, oh, come here, you know, come here and have a land, you know, be in the beauty, make the desert bloom. It wasn't a desert that needed blooming. It was full of, I mean, I'm sure you two know what it was full of, but, you know, I don't have the idea that it was this empty desert that needed blooming. It, things grew, people lived for it. Leah and I, my wife who's passed, would go to plays about the Nakba. You know, we would witness here in New York, there were, whenever there was a Palestinian playwright or event or something, we would always go. And I remember the image of people living in a home and then saying, no, you don't live here anymore. We watched a movie similarly, that this is a Palestinian home. No, it's not anymore. This is a Palestinian set of swings. No, not anymore. We're taking it. I mean, so much like the indigenous people here in North America, whose land was just, no, it's ours now, by dint of force. And of course, the indigenous people had to fight back, or there'd be none of them left. The idea was to wipe them all out because they weren't good at being slaves, the indigenous people in North America. You know, so wipe them all out, which is what we're hearing from the Israeli regime, wants to wipe all of you. Oh, it's excruciating. And thank you for posting every day from your cousins. We're so grateful to hear from them and to call them our cousins. Thank you,
Jane. I do want to add a couple things, Jane, to what you said. When they said that there's nothing on that land, our family land as land was full of lemon trees and orange trees, and that was our family business. you know, so it was not an empty land. And also, I didn't want to speak on behalf of Jews. So thank you for saying everything that you said, because from, you know, when we're educating ourselves, we look at all perspectives. We hear also from Israelis and Jewish communities and of their experience. And I agree with you, Jane, they are using the Jewish experience, the Jewish pain. But I didn't want to speak for Jews. So thank you for putting that in. And also, I also wanted to say that what Palestinians are going through is already so horrible. But in addition to that, one of the things that just really breaks my heart is the propaganda. The way they have turned the stories to make it look like we are bad, we are the problem, we are awful, we are the bad child causing issues, is just horrible, because we're already going through so much. But in addition to that, we also have to defend ourselves non-stop. And even sometimes we do, but we're still not heard. We're still told we're lying and we're wrong. So that to me is just even like so much more damaging. It's one thing to go through everything we're going through, but on top of that, watching other people, witnessing people, telling us we're the crazy ones.
Yeah, the level of gaslighting that's happening, you know, like on a societal level, it's horrific, and it's also not new, you know. Like this idea of feeling unsafe, and Danielle and I were talking about this the other day, is this idea that's being perpetuated of, like, you know, it is really people feeling unsafe, you know, and it's not to make the feeling. Yeah, of course. You know, the feeling is true, the feeling of feeling unsafe, but, you know, let's slow that down. And, you know, to frame it more in the somatic and the grief work, it's like, let's slow that down and, like, recognize, like, where is that fear of not being safe actually coming from? Well, every Jewish person on this planet has the lineage of the Holocaust, you know, in their ancestry and that ancestral trauma, right? And so that's very, and I'd love to hear just your response to this, Jane, but, you know, that's very present in the body, just as, you know, me as an Irish person, the Irish genocide is present in my body. And so even witnessing what's going on now here, it's like, it's definitely triggering seeing what's happening. And so, you know, of course, like, having, you know, 1,200 people killed, who are your neighbors, who are your fellow Israeli people, that would trigger that feeling of, like, oh my God, it's the Holocaust over all over again. But that's a good time to pause, right? And say, like, is that what's really happening? Is that what's really happening? Or is it actually the opposite of what's really happening? You know, is it that we need to reflect and look at what we're doing, you know, as not only as Israel, but as the colonial nations, you know, moving in this world and trying to maintain this power, you know, this illusion of power over others so that we can feel safe, quote unquote safe, right? And is that really what gives us power is that really what gives us safety, is having power over others? I don't think so. You know, it's when we're together and, you know, band arms together and see, you know, see each other's humanity, that we really create safety. So, yeah, I'd love to hear just anything any of you want to say about that, but maybe I'll go to Jane first and then.
Well, the head of that government is making a war so that he can stay in office. Let's just be clear. You know, this is power over caring about hostages from his own people. You know, it's like he doesn't give a hoot about the hostages, you know, the two that he took out this morning, the Argentinians, they were treated well. You know, the IDF has murdered several of the hostages. I don't know how many yet, we won't know. But he's taking this war to the end, not because he cares, really. It's just he needs to stay in office. And so, you know, this is extremely corrupt. And before this, the Israelis were up in arms about him because he was trying to take the judiciary away. But those same Israelis wavered after October 7th because A, they knew some of the people, you know, and so there is heartbreak all around. There's heartbreak. But, you know, having been raised as an anti-racist and a resistor, I had to, you know, I felt the heartbreak. It took me weeks of just whispering in the synagogues and the Palestinians, the hostages. I would say, you know, people would pray for the hostages, and I would say, and the Palestinians. But each week I would get daggers at me for saying that, and I had to stop going. And I wrote to all the rabbis that, you know, that I was taking a hiatus, you know, hoping that, you know, I could say the Palestinians, you know. I mean, I wrote that like maybe 3 weeks, 4 weeks in, and I heard back from two of the rabbis. One spoke to me for an hour and said, "You're not alone," although, you know, she didn't say anything more about it. They're all females, and this is the largest gay and lesbian synagogue in the world here in New York City. And another is willing to meet with me to have lunch. She's so sorry for my pain. But my wife is buried there. You know, it's like she's being held hostage in hostile territory. And, you know, so I have little, you know, I'm very torn. It's very polarizing to feel that these very kind people who cared when I said, my cousin in Palestine has died. I said, the cousin of my cousin has died. And I got all these responses about the cousin of my cousin, and they all love me and Leah and so forth and so on. But anything that I write, if I say, and we also have to pray for all the Palestinians who've died, people look at me like I'm speaking another language, very much, Daniela, what you're saying about being criminalized just for being. And so I think it's a matter of the narrative of the Hasbara, the gaslighting, as Josiah put it, is just, wait a minute, you care about babies, you care about people, you have a sanctuary for immigrants in the synagogue, you know, you care. You know, after 9/11, you visited a local mosque every Friday to welcome with Jews, to welcome people to pray. And all of that has fallen apart now. You know, it just, you forgot how when the Pittsburgh synagogue was attacked and people were killed, you came, the people from that mosque came to protect us walking into synagogue that Friday. You know, did you forget something? You've forgotten something here. And it's shocking to the point of physical illness. It's very somatic.
If you could wish something, Jane, or if you could, like, if you had a, yeah, like an intention or like a wish for your fellow Jewish people who have forgotten, who are not seeing the humanity in Palestinians, who are kind of, even though maybe they think, you know, shouldn't be resolved with violence and they don't necessarily agree with Israel, you know, even there, but they still are not like seeing the humanity of Palestinians fully. What would you wish for them?
Take the crust off your eyes. Please take the crust out of your eyes and see your sister and brothers and cousins, and care, and strategize. You're smart. You strategize solutions with the Palestinians in leadership. This is their land. You know, so the issue of truth that Caroline brought up, you know, many paragraphs ago. This is about truth, you know, grapple with the truth and humble yourself to the truth. You've made terrible mistakes, terrible. I mean, Biden went to Michigan and said he made mistakes because he wants votes. But, you know, it's just for votes, you know, this terrible moment we're in, because who in Michigan from the Muslim community, or Teaneck from the Palestinian community — we have a huge Palestinian community here in Teaneck, New Jersey — who could bear to pull the lever for Joe Biden? But he had to say, we've made some mistakes. You know, the humility of saying, oh my gosh, Jane, I'm so sorry, not to me personally, but, you know, we should be screaming Palestinians in every week, every day, you know, that these are our cousins. We're all Semites, for God's sake. We're all Semites. Does that answer you?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you for emphasizing that, Jane. We are all Semites, and I'm so glad to hear you say that, because this is a point that I can't stress enough to the community. So thank you for saying that. And I think it's really unfortunate, if I can add a little bit more, that, you know, we are made to think that this is a war between, you know, it's a religious war, right? You know, associating Palestinian identity with Islam is what the West wants us to do, right? Is because they want to create this illusion that this is a war between religions, because when to take away from the actual reason, which is it's an occupation, it's apartheid. But, you know, they're using the disguise of this is a religious war and people are not getting along. And if it weren't for what's going on today for Israel and for the Zionist regime, we would be talking today about Palestinian Jews who fought alongside other Palestinians. And that's just the reality. But we can't even speak of Palestinian Jews. We can't even bring them into the conversation, because we're all sort of, you know, the society is mixed into this idea that this is a religious war and that this is, you know, Islam, you know, Jews versus Muslims. And this is exactly, in my opinion, what the agenda is, to, you know, so that we're not looking at the truth, which is that it's a colonial project, it's apartheid, it's occupation.
Mm-hmm. And it's also,
so thank you.
Oh, sorry, Caroline, but also it's not safe for Jews to speak up. They're also being attacked like us. They're also being suppressed. They're also being labeled as anti-Jews. So it's really anybody that's speaking against the agenda is being suppressed and bullied, and which is of course not okay. And just to add to what Jane was saying earlier, for me, for my friends and my community that has been silent or cutting us off, I don't even want an apology. My only ask is to just open your heart and ask questions and be curious. The fact that, you know, for me, people meet me and will say things like, you're such a good friend, or a great listener, or it's so great to have you. And then suddenly when I speak up for Palestine, they disappear. It's like, you forgot who I am. You forgot all the good experiences you had of me and how I've showed up in your life because I'm standing up for Palestinians. You forgot my human side, my heart, my soul, because I'm speaking up for Palestinians. And to be honest, for the last 40 years of my life, I would be scared. When people would ask me what my background is, I would say Lebanese. That's the truth. I would not say Palestinian. One, because it wasn't safe to be Palestinian. And second, because, to be honest, a lot of people didn't even know what Palestine was. They'd be like, where's that? They had no clue. And so I would not say it. And now, because the narrative is changing, like Jane and Caroline were saying earlier, and Amber, now I feel safer to say I'm Palestinian. Now I'm proud. I feel free to say that I'm Palestinian, even though there is an impact. There is an impact. I am losing people. you know, I'm losing friends. You know, it hasn't impacted, you know, my career or my work, but on my with my friends, it has had an impact. And it just breaks my heart that you were there and you were loving me when I was just being me. But now that I'm bringing in my Palestinian voice, suddenly I'm dangerous.
Yeah, and it also had the impact even goes beyond that. Like, just to give you an example, my sisters and I, every time, you know, we've been offering support, you know, financial support to our family in Gaza, you know, periodically, whenever they can access funds. But it's actually quite the dilemma amongst the three of us to decide what, you know, whether or not it's safe for us to send that money for us, right? Like, they're in desperate need over there of funds, of, you know, basic needs. And we are worried about our safety here. You know, how, like, are we going to get, you know, in trouble for sending money to Gaza? Like, how does that look, you know, for us, our experience here? You know, not to get into Canadian politics or anything like that, but seeing what happened a few years ago with the convoy and how people got reprimanded and, you know, around sending money to certain organizations, then we're fearful of what. So here as Palestinians, you know, you can't freely practice, you know, or donate money the way that you want to, when you can essentially donate to any organization outside of that.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of the illegality of BDS, a boycott, divest, and sanction. And the federal government in the US has taken this very, you know, sensible movement, nonviolent movement, and made it illegal for anybody getting federal money to boycott, divest, or sanction from Israel. And so I understand your fear. I mean, there's I'm filled with fear every day. Every day, yeah. There's lots of fear.
I mean, there's a punitive impact, right? I mean, it's evident now that anyone who supports Palestine and who's not following the narrative, you know, there's punishment.
I mean, I just had a fear that if, you know, for people to hear this from the synagogue, you know, I want to say, and I loved you all, and I love what you did for us as a lesbian couple over, you know, more than a decade and a half. And I love how you cared for us and you were so awesome. I want to be able to say to you, you're a glorious group of people. And here are my Palestinian sisters, you know, and I want you to hear them too. You know, I need you to hear them so that I can be full and whole with you.
I just want to take a moment to track back to and kind of underline another point that was made around, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, the Canadian government the last, you know, I think 5-ish years has been apologizing, maybe it's even 10 years at this point, has been apologizing through this truth and reconciliation, you know, that's been happening with the Indigenous people here. And I think that it's very convenient to apologize, you know, once 80% of the population has been wiped out, which is the case in North America. We're at 20, we have 20% approximately left of the original Indigenous population. And so there's no longer, you know, the colonization has happened. There's not the quote unquote Indigenous problem years and years ago of people actually having their sovereignty and their culture and their rights and their land. It's like, they don't have that land anymore. They're already colonized. And so not to say that there isn't still possibility of some healing and happening, but I think that it's very common to, like, this is kind of the colonial model is, you know, have, you know, go in, colonize a people, destroy, you know, a large portion of them. And then actually, this is the old model, you know, the original model of colonization is then send those people to the next town, you know, to colonize the next town, right? Because they've already lost so much. And you know, this is exactly what that model. It's like, if you know the model of how colonization works, then it's not hard to see the next layer of it, which is that's the exact model that is being used in this, has been used in this situation. And, you know, will it be that, you know, 10 years or 20 years from now, there's apologies about what's happening now? Well, it's too late at that point. We have to, already it's too late, you know, already it's too late. There's so much that's been lost. And it's like, how about now, before any more is lost, rather than, you know, once the colonization job is fully done, right? How about now? And how about we make it more than lip service? How about we, you know, actually, you know, hear the Palestinian voices now and look for a way to create peace, you know, because that, I mean, that's another thing that I understand is that Israel has multiple times rejected, you know, peace offers from Hamas, from the party that was it the Palestinian Liberation? Yeah, PLM. Yeah, prior to Hamas, and just kind of constantly done things to undermine the possibility of peace. And because the ultimate regime is from the river to the sea, right? That's in their charter, from the river to the sea, Jewish sovereignty, pure Jewish sovereignty. And that is not acknowledging the Palestinians as a people that have lived in that land. And even now Hamas is willing to compromise, you know, it actually, the whole land is Palestinian and should be. And yet Hamas is willing to compromise and willing to, you know, work towards the two-state solution. And you know, so if Hamas is willing to do that, if Palestinians are willing to do that, certainly, you know, the occupier should be willing to do that. Yeah.
And sadly, that's the problem, because the occupier does not want to. And I think the first step here, because the change is not going to come from the top. We all know this. The change is going to start with us. And even Jane saying that Biden is changing his story because of his votes. He's not doing it because he believes in it, but he's doing it because of the pressure that the people are putting. And it starts with us. And the first step is for us to continue educating people and sharing, and for others to start acknowledging that we are the indigenous people. We are the people of this land, and we're not saying we don't want to share it. We've never actually said that. We just said that we want to be on our land and be free on our land. We want to exist, the right to exist. Sorry, go ahead, Caroline.
And have our homes back, you know, like we've been kicked out of our homes. Some people still have the key to their homes, the key to return. So, you know, it's that's what they ask for, is to be able to return to our homes, to our lands, and to go back to having, you know, basic human rights. Yeah.
Yeah. And our grandfather, when he passed away, he left land for us, for my father, for our father. And so for us, my sisters and I, we don't have access to it. We do not have access to it. Where any stranger anywhere in the world can decide tomorrow they're Jewish and have access to that land.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
Makes no sense.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think we could talk a lot more, but I want to start to maybe draw to a close. So maybe I'd love to just go around our circle one more time here, and just anything that you want to leave us with today. Leave our listeners with today as just, you know, a final thought. And maybe I'll go to Jane and then Amber.
I heard a chant at a rally last week: from the sea to the river, Palestine forever. From the sea, I messed it up. From the sea to the river, Palestine forever. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Yeah.
Yeah. One last note. I think as the settler myself, as the person who is not on land that's their own, but is now within a government that is in place and is enacting on my behalf throughout the world, for those people who think that this is not their issue, I mean, of course, first, it's a human issue. It's a humanity issue. There's no question about that. But if you think it's not your issue, our governments have a big hand in what's happening. We pay our tax dollars to these governments. We vote in these governments. We give these governments the right to act on our behalf in our country and internationally. And no matter what our leaders say, both the US and Canada have a huge, huge legacy, first of being colonizers themselves, of course, we have colonial governments, and then of enacting support for regimes across the world who have been oppressors, including Israel, and still give support to Israel, the US and Canada. Before we had Trudeau, Stephen Harper was a huge, huge outspoken supporter of Israel. And all of the US governments, when I was in Israel and Palestine, I usually just refer to it as Palestine. People don't usually understand. But, you know, in the territories, like going around the markets everywhere in Israel, there were T-shirts, every single stall that had the US and Israel next to each other with military propaganda. Like we're buddies, like they support us. It was crazy. I still have photos of every single one I saw everywhere. It's like, it's true. It's just the truth. That is just the truth. And that's where our personal responsibility lies, is through our own government. We all have a part to play in this, and it's essential that we recognize that. We cannot just turn away. Like, we are part of that legacy. Like, we are intertwined with it. And so I just like want to leave people with that. If you think this doesn't have anything to do with you, like, I'm surely it does. And there are no actions too small to help. You know, we're not going to take everything down and put it back together in one moment or just by ourselves. We all have like whatever small roles we can play, but like there's a role and there's mm-hmm. a reason to have that role.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Amber. Can I go to Caroline and then Daniela?
Yeah. I love that, Amber. Thank you so much. I have been putting out a lot of content myself personally on my page, just regarding exactly what you just said, that, you know, every small action, I mean, and we're watching sort of the ripple effect, domino effect of our small actions and how they show up globally. So thank you for that. I think the piece that I'd like to leave our community with is that I hope that this conversation today really drives home the point that this issue really is not that complicated. Right. I mean, we often hear it's too complicated, or I can't decide, or I see both sides, and it's really not that complicated. So I just want to leave people with that, and also just say how open I think we all are to answer questions. And I certainly want to make myself available to answer questions as a Palestinian Canadian, person. I just want to put it out there that I welcome questions.
Great. Yeah. And maybe we can, on that note, those of us who are open to answer questions, contact our contact info in the show notes. So if you do want to interact with any of us, and of course, like loving, kind interaction, fully invited. Any kind of hate mail will be immediately blocked. We're not interested in that kind of thing. And if, you know, if that is what you're in, you know, if you're inspired in that way to send things that are hateful, you know, we just really ask that you turn towards and be curious about what's happening inside of you, that you feel that you would need to send energy out in that way. Because ultimately, you know, ultimately, as Amber was saying, you know, it does come back to each and every one of us. And like, that is the first step, is turning towards ourselves and being curious about, you know, where am I triggered? Where am I upset about this? Where am I, you know, where do I feel I get knocked off my center in this? Where do I feel passionate about? Where do, you know, what unhealed traumas are influencing my reaction, or places where I don't want to look at the truth or even be curious? So anyways, I want to go to Daniela as well before we finish up. Sorry to interrupt you there.
Thank you. So, I mean, for me, I think what I want to say to our communities is that, yes, October 7th was not okay. You know, yes, what the hostages are going through is not okay. Yes, what the families of all hostages are going through is not okay. Like, I feel you, I hear you. I have compassion for all families and everyone going through this. I absolutely am with you 100% here. And all I'm asking is for you, is for people to just be curious, to ask questions, to open their hearts. And instead of just sticking to the one side they're hearing, to ask Palestinians of their experience, but also ask Israeli Jews or Jews that have been to Israel and Palestine and Gaza and have seen with their own eyes what's really going on. I'm just asking for you to hear them. And then you can decide for yourself, you know, what, how you want to feel. My only ask is to just open your heart and just be curious and ask questions and see for yourself who we are and what we stand for. And, you know, my intention is for all Palestinians, Christians, Jews, and Muslims to be safe. That's my intention. And I don't think one is better than the other. I just, everyone is hurting and we acknowledge that. We're also saying there's more to it. Please hear us.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Yeah. And yeah, there is, you know, there is actually a lot of Israelis who are speaking for Palestine now too. And maybe we'll, some of them that we know will include in the show notes as well. So if you want that perspective, I think, which is a valuable one. So thank you all so much for your voices and for gathering today with me. I'm just so humbled and honored to, and grateful to be in the presence of each of you and your huge hearts and to our listeners and, you know, their hearts, because I know to come and listen to a talk like this, you know, where we're talking about, an issue that is so big and so, I was working with my therapist this morning and we were talking about it and she said, it's like in therapy, we talk about double binds where it's like it seems like there's no good solution. It's like, you do this, it's bad in that way. You do that, it's bad in that way. And there's no winning. And always, you know, from that somatic, you know, therapeutic context, there's always a third way through. There always is. And it just takes enough reflection and curiosity and being willing to own our own fear, our own trauma, our own shit, being willing to work with it enough that we can then come to the table and start to open to that possibility of that third way. And I think the first step is just like, okay, there's got to be a third way, you know, there always is, you know, so bringing that curiosity to the table, being willing to understand, you know, the full perspective rather than just taking in, like, you know, and even starting to with the information that you may have taken in the past, starting to just be curious, like, could that be propaganda? Like, if it was, what purpose would that serve? What purpose does it serve, you know, the powers that be for me to believe this? Like, how does that serve the agenda of colonialism? What if I opened to something, another possibility? How would that possibly undermine the colonial agenda? And just to be curious, start to be curious about that. So yeah, that's my little rant about that one. Thank you all so much. And
thank you. What an honor. Thank you.
This has been Through the Dark Woods podcast. I'm your host, Josiah Tamir Crossley, and thanks for listening today. If you are looking for support to process your own grief or would like to learn more about trainings to support others, check out darkwoodsofgrief.com.